I mean, you said that Mark Lane said that a man told him, but did it actually happen?
If you fly down to New Orleans, I can show you these people talking, but you just invited one person up here. I'm telling you what they said. Each time I tell you, you say, is that a fact? All I can say is that it appears to me to be a fact. If you want to reject it, you can.
All right.
But let me show you some pictures, and if you want to reject these, go ahead. In the 26 volumes...
You're not on trial, Jim. I'm just asking. As really, I've...
Yeah, but I'm afraid another advertisement may be coming up.
You're right about that, too.
In the 26 volumes, there is no reference to any serious sort of arrest. There are a couple of references to short dialogues, and then the indication is that the man wasn't of any value or any importance at all. Actually, at Dealey Plaza, there were 10 men arrested, and this has been kept secret for more than 4 years. Here are the pictures of 5 of them being arrested, and they've never been shown before.
Well, I don't know.
Several of these men arrested have been connected by our office with a Central Intelligence Agency of the United States government. The probability is that this is why Officer Tippett was killed. Is this speculation? Positively, and I want to identify it as that. But the probability appears to be that the killing of Tippett was the diversion which allowed them to turn loose these 10 men. Here's some more. And here's another.
It won't show, Jim.
But why aren't they mentioned? Why aren't they mentioned? They're not
mentioned. Yeah, but you say speculation and the probability.
I don't understand.
Who's suppressing all of this information on whose order?
I'll tell you who's suppressing it. The federal government is suppressing it.
Who in the federal government?
The administration of your government is suppressing it because they know that the Central Intelligence Agency...
On whose order?
On the order of the President of the United States. Who do you think issued... Let me finish now.
I didn't say a thing.
Before the advertisement. The executive order, which forbids every person in this audience and every person listening to this program, which forbids them to look at this evidence until September in the year 2039, was issued by the President of the United States. Does that answer your question? He's suppressing it.
For what possible reason?
Why don't you ask him, John?
I know what he'd say.
Welcome back to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is my pleasure to have Donald Jeffries back on the show. He, of course, Donald is an independent researcher, a best-selling author whose books include On Borrowed Fame, Money, Mysteries, and Corruption in the Entertainment World, Bullyocracy, How the Social Hierarchy Enables Bullies to Rule Schools, Workplaces, and Society at Large. Don's work can be followed, on your Substack page, right?
Right. Donald Jeffries at Substack.com.
That's what it is. Okay, so I'll provide the link for that as when I post the show. Well, tonight you're back to talk about a new book that you have co-authored with Mr. William Mattson Law. This is regarding, the Garrison case and JFK assassination. The title, I guess perhaps you can explain.
it's not
Jim Garrison, JFK assassination. It's not... On the Trail of the Assassins. Pipe the Bimbo in the Red, Dean Andrews, Jim Garrison, and the Conspiracy to Kill JFK. Now, most people know Jim Garrison as Kevin Costner. And, of course, Dean Andrews, he's John Candy. Of course, right. I'm referring to the 1991 film JFK that was directed by Oliver Stone, which I believe was based on the book Trail of the Assassins by Garrison, by Jim Garrison, and also right. Crossfire, the plot that killed Kennedy by Jim Mars. That's right. It was adapted. That was from that story. The Jim Garrison, of course, Jim Garrison was the New Orleans district attorney who I think is the only one ever to prosecute anyone associated, at least allegedly associated with yes. Kennedy's assassination. Right. I think it was Clay Shaw.
Yep.
And of course, Clay Shaw was acquitted, so he's officially innocent. But nevertheless, more has come out since then. I think at the time, Garrison lacked the evidence that Shaw was linked to the CIA. And of course, subsequent evidence has exposed that. But this book, first of all, another Kennedy book.
Yeah. Well, you know, I probably should have more than one Kennedy book in there. It's my wheelhouse issue.
Yeah.
This one was really William Mattson Law, my co-author, who's a mm-hmm. great researcher. He's probably I think he's the go-to guy in the autopsy evidence. He's written books like In the Eye of History and other books dealing with the autopsy evidence. He's very unheralded researcher. He's underrated. This was his idea. He found out I knew that I had been friends with Dean Andrews III for over 20 years, mm-hmm. close friends, and because he was my brother's best friend, you know, to help. How my brother came into his orbit, it is really one of those coincidences. There are some coincidences. They just hit it off and became best friends. And he started bringing Dean, you know, to, of course, I was fascinated with him. So he started bringing him to family gatherings. We used to entertain a lot. And so we would see Dean several times a year. He came almost like one of the family. And there's a nice picture in the book of him and me and my brother sitting at our dining room table, one of those gatherings. And so he was as interested in me as I was in him, because he didn't, you know, I had all this knowledge about his father and everything. He really hadn't studied his father's Warren Commission testimony or anything much. And but you know, when you get to know somebody, I just wasn't sure there was a book there in him. And then William would say, well, you got to do this. So then, you know, the more I warmed up to the idea, and I thought, well, let's write. I haven't written a JFK book per se. Even though I have a 10th book out, you know, in a few months here. But he said, you know, this, I'm going to concentrate, because one of my pet peeves has been for a long time, is that the critics, a lot of the critics in the research community, keep stressing this Cuban angle, which I think is a huge smokescreen. And mm-hmm. I think what we set out to do in this book is we looked at the, and of course, built around Dean's father, the guy played by John Candy, Dean Andrews Jr. He's a central character in the book, because I think his story has been underreported. People have been, and I think he's an essential character here. He's the one really that triggered, you know, his Garrison's investigation after he was, you know, apprised of it. Russell Long, the Huey Long son, he, you know, the first things that really caused attention was the testimony of Dean Andrews Jr. in the Warren Commission, who was his friend, a close friend. As young Dean, Dean III told me many times, you know, Jim Garrison would call the house up and say, hello, young Dean. And they would, you know, they would each other at the New Orleans Athletic Club a lot, socially. So this really interested him, because he knew of Dean Andrews Jr. And but that's what got, I think, what propelled him. But the way I differ, and William does too, from the other critics, I think, is that we tried to show that these, what I call the New Orleans ground level conspiracy, and that's what we concentrated on this book. David Ferry and all the anti-Castro Cubans, Guy Bannister, Jack Martin, and Jack Rubin, even though he wasn't in New Orleans per se, he was part of that group. And of course, Clay Shaw, who I think Clay Shaw was the conduit between what the ground level conspirators and the real conspirators were probably working through him, and I think all those people were manipulated. First and foremost, Oswald, because Oswald was being manipulated to be the patsy. I believe that he was an assignment at the time of the assassination for the FBI or the CIA, whoever he's working for.
Now, Oswald did claim he was a patsy. That's on film, right?
Yes, yes. Yes, indeed, he did. And I think he was, you know, he was manipulated into this position by being told by his handlers, whatever intelligence agency he was on a time for, that you need to infiltrate this plot. There's a plot brewing in New Orleans to assassinate the president. And in fact, everybody in that ground level conspiracy, Oh, I mean, David Ferry was certainly on the record. All the anti-Castro Cubans, Guy Bannister, Jack Martin, all these people were on the record as hating Kennedy. And they certainly would. I mean, they said SOB should be killed, you know, Ferry said and so forth. So they would have joined a real conspiracy if they could have. But I don't think they were powerful enough. I think they were being manipulated. But, ironically enough, out of that entire group of New Orleans ground-level conspirators, the only one who didn't hate Kennedy and wouldn't have participated in a real conspiracy to kill JFK was Oswald. Oswald only expressed positive feelings about JFK. He can't come up with any negative statement he ever made about him, which is a curious attitude to have for someone you're targeting for assassination, naturally. But so we wanted to, show that we basically, Garrison went into, Oliver Stone, went into this area in, in some depth in the film, but, he could only scratch the surface in a film. So I think we went into it much deeper. And there's a couple of firsts in this book. First of all, Dean Andrews III never spoken out in the public before. So he goes on the record for the first time, and we have a list of transcripts of the interviews that William did with him. And I was able to contact the family of Ed Vogel, who was Lee Harvey Oswald's best friend in high school. And I had long suspected he'd been murdered. He died very young in suspicious circumstances. And I won't give any spoiler alerts, but I talked to his family several times, and they had some very interesting things to say. So people, and no one had talked to them before. This is the first time they were record. So, this New Orleans was a fertile ground for these conspirators. A lot of stuff was going on there. And, Oliver Stone makes a lot of that in a great scene where he's saying, over there is the CIA, and there's offices of Naval Intelligence, and of course, Guy Bannister's office. Guy Bannister was a ex-FBI man who'd lost his job in the police for being too violent, too anti-communist, too racist, whatever. But he was about as strong an anti-communist as you could get in that time period. So the idea that Lee Harvey Oswald, this Marxist defector, supposedly, would share an address with them, and the address wasn't the same, but there were two entrances to the same building. So Bannister would go in one door in the front, and Oswald would go in the door on the side. But
didn't they share it with the Riley Coffee Company?
No, Riley Coffee Company was that was where Oswald worked before. We go into that in some depth too, but that's a very suspicious place because the Riley himself had some dubious connections. We go into that book, but as you may or may not know, when Jim Garrison was investigating Oswald's background, he looked at the Riley Coffee Company, and his people went there and to talk to people, tried to talk to some of his coworkers. To their astonishment, they found that pretty much all of them were gone. And they didn't work anymore. But what was even more amazing was that they'd all gone to the same place. They'd all gone to work for NASA.
Yes, so I remember that detail. I read that in the book Mary's Monkey.
Yeah,
Mary's Monkey. Didn't they look at his time card and he timed in and timed at exact the same time every day or something? It was some odd.
Yeah, he had lots of weird things. And of course, he was seen supposedly getting a package or handing off a package or something to some guy in a black car or something. That people suspect it was an FBI.
So it was probably a front.
Yeah, lots of intrigue going on. And you mentioned,
especially if it's involved in importing stuff from Latin America, you can suspect.
And again, you mentioned Dr. Mary's Monkey, and Ed Haslam, who wrote that book, he wrote the preface to our book. People can read what he had to say in there, because you obviously know a lot about the...
And the story of Judith Faith Baker also is a completely different narrative provides a completely different narrative on one Lee Harvey Oswald.
Right. We don't go into that too much because I don't know. Who knows, whether anybody's telling the truth. And I'm skeptical, but I'm kind of an agnostic on Judith Baker. But, and I know Ed Haslam, obviously, laser, and lots of other people do too. But she has a lot more fans than I do. So she's become very popular. But I don't discount anything. I think that she did know. I think that she worked with Oswald, and they may have had some kind of relationship. I don't know. Like that weird
cancer research angle.
Right. Well, and we know Mary Sherman We know Mary Sherman died, you know, and they, you know, you talk about, it was, you know, in a fire, but she was shot to the heart or something. Yes, I just very
there was something mafia-esque. With the with the arm being disintegrated with that collider or something down there at Tulane. There's a research facility, and they figure the fire and the stab to the heart was a cover up or something, or a put out or something. That involves even the what's that cancer? I'm going off on a tangent. I'm sorry, but it involves the polio vaccine. An Alton Ochsner,
Oxner, we go into Ochsner a lot.
Yeah,
in the book, because the Ochsner Clinic was a clinic that specialized in serving healthcare for third world dictators. But that's where Lee Harvey Oswald, that's where Ed Vogel died very mysteriously. And Ochsner had also had strong ties to Clay Shaw. And we talk about that. He was so close to Shaw that Shaw had an office reserved for him in the trademark, which he was president of the National Trademark. So these are the connections. We go a lot into Clay Shaw and, he certainly wasn't any kind of kindly philanthropist. He had not only connections to CIA, but people like Ochsner, Herman Dex, a corporation, we kind of explore that a little bit. There was in the movie, The Parallax View with Warren Beatty, kind of a fictionalized account of Herman Dex, most people think.
The Parallax Corporation, yes. Welcome to the Parallax Corporation.
right. So it certainly... You know, and they have ties through that to Pio Gelli and Roberto Calvi, you know, the U2, not the U2, the C2, the Masonic, Italian
P2,
Masonic.
P2, propaganda.
Propaganda. Yeah. And the, you know, the Calvi's body, you know, hanging under Blackfriars Bridge, you know, very.
Yeah, that's like 20 years later after the Kennedy assassination.
Yeah. So there's a, you know, May Brussell when she was alive, Mr. Red. A lot about that, but you know, the Shaw was, and some people think he may have been head of Permanex, but he was certainly on his board of directors. And there were other interesting people. One of Hitler's very close aides at one time was there, as was the former president of Hungary. So you know, it wasn't just
at Permanex.
Yeah, Permanex. Yeah.
Yeah, and then of course it's owned by a Jewish banker.
Well, so, what is it?
Like. It's like the trademark was owned by the Permadex was operated by the Tibor Rosenbaum out of the Swiss International Credit Bank or something.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's the Israeli connection, which also causes a lot of stir within the JFK research community, because you can't mention the possible Israeli angle.
Let's get it. You can't. You're poor Michael Collins Piper, who I had just started communicating with a bit, but when he died. Way too young of heart disease. I don't know who knows what suspicion not, but he was young. And he wrote the book Final Judgment. And that was the first book to ever postulate an Israeli connection. And I tried to get the research community to embrace him on the forums. And, you know, he wouldn't go because he said he knew what their attitude would be. And their attitude was horrible towards him, typically, or anti-Semitic and all. But ironically, now you fast forward, I see people discuss the Israeli connection. And it's all his research. Don't give him credit for it at all. But now they kind of say, "Yeah, well, JFK was involved behind the scenes in a battle with David Ben Gurion about Israel's nuclear program," which he was. But Michael Collins Piper was the one that first exposed that. So
he would agree with you that the Cuban and CIA angle is a misdirection.
Yeah, it is, because the most obvious thing is that, you know, and I've tried to argue this with critics, and they're so hooked on the because there were undeniably all these Cubans everywhere. But if you look, they're all in New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
I say the ground level conspiracy, they all hanging, you know, they're hanging around Oswald. They're hanging around Dean Andrews Jr. Dean Andrews Jr. was the lawyer for these guys. He called them Caballeros.
Weren't all these Cubans also involved, like, in the Watergate break-in?
Yeah, same kind of thing. So, exactly. Even some of the same players.
You have all these, you know, desperados, if you will, that are twiddling their thumbs. What do you do with them? Well, you get them involved in things. And they'd be the perfect patsies because, A, they have motive for it, but you can set them up for it and not actually be involved in it. It's a perfect cover.
And you can throw the old canard, well, they were pissed off at him because of the Bay of Pigs. You know, the Cubans hated him because of that. And you know, the Nixon would even talk about the whole Bay of Pigs things, which people think that was code for assassination. But as I said, you know, the simplest way to look at this is that if there, Cuba, the fact that, okay, we killed, one of the reasons they killed JFK was because he wanted rapprochement with Castro and didn't want to have another invasion of Cuba, wanted the CIA to stop trying to assassinate him. Well, if that's the case, what happened after the assassination? Cuba died as a campaign issue. The CIA never tried to assassinate him again.
Mm-hmm.
LBJ never launched a Bay of Pigs 2. And Castro outlived them all. So, you know, what was, so that makes no sense, because obviously they pulled off a coup that was very successful, because they're still lying about it and covering up 60 years later. Why would they do that if, you know, their main reason for killing him? So that's, I really hate the concentration on the Castro thing. And people, again, they're just not looking deep enough. Where do these figures come from? Now, there were, like in the book, we talked about Dean III talks about going with his father to the Alpha 66 training camps for the exiles. So that, but again, that's his, because his father was being ensnared in that for whatever reason too.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, all these guys, they may have even thought that too, because a lot of the Cubans, especially with shadowy figures, Carlos Bringier is still alive. Both William and I, we were both scared to try to contact him. He's a scary figure. You know, he's in the 90s, and he's very out there, and he's very outspoken, saying Castro killed Kennedy. So it's, you know, when somebody's that committed and has that kind of background, I'm not gonna be able to change his mind.
Mm-hmm.
There's no point in talking to him, but he's not going to say anything that's other than just the smoke train stuff. But other than him, he's the last one left alive. And that's why Garrison, when, I don't know if Garrison knew, because Garrison thought CIA basically Kennedy, but I don't know.
Well, that's such a broad, which CIA? What do you say? Yeah. CIA did it? Who? I mean, right. Who?
Well, that's
there's
right.
A CIA within the CIA. You could look at him. Well, he was put onto the case by Haley Boggs, right?
Well, that's, some people say Haley Boggs, and others like Garrison had Russell Long, who was Huey Long's son. But you know, and Haley Boggs was the closest thing the Warren Commission had to a dissenter.
And what happened to him?
And he disappeared on a plane. It was never found again with Representative Nick Beckett, whose son, I think, is still in Congress, or wasn't for a while.
He was in the Senate.
Yeah. Coach Alex Jones for a while. But he was driven to the airport on his flight to oblivion by a very young Bill Clinton.
Yes. Yes.
Those are the coincidences.
These are the things I remember. Yeah, I've forgotten that detail. Bill Clinton drove him to the airport.
Yeah. I talked about that in history, because it is in history. But yeah, he got started young on associating with people about to die. So, you know,
and there's also a photo of Bill Clinton shaking Kennedy's hand too.
Yeah, I wondered about that too. What are the odds that, I mean, I'd like to look and see, okay, how many of those Boy Scouts were they all given a courtesy? It's possible they could have all been, you know, given a courtesy photograph. I don't know that for sure. If that's the case, it's, you know, something, but if somehow Clinton was the only one or one of only a few, then what are the odds of that? But yeah, it's pretty strange. But so I think that Garrison probably had bigger, you know, aspirations to try to, and when he said the CIA, people say the CIA is right, is institutional. It means, I think he met, and again, people talk about the Ioannidis and, you know, David Attlee Phillips and all of these particular parts of the CIA, but most people think Alan Dulles probably involved. I mean, Alan Dulles was fired by JFK after the Bay of Pigs. He hated the Kennedys.
So naturally, you put him in charge of the investigation.
Exactly. So who else are you going to put on the commission? Talking about the fox guard and the hen house. But
I mean, there was Operation Mongoose, which Kennedy actually and his brother actually started. It was sort of this all catch-all program to unseat Castro, which involved assassinations, among other little dirty tricks. And from a broader, if you look at it from a broad angle or take a step back, okay, the intelligence community has this operation for assassination and regime change, so they have the mechanics in place to do it. So it's just a simple matter of reverse engineering and going after, you know, a sitting president as opposed to going after a Latin dictator, you know. And so that's how it would have happened. It's also, that doesn't mean that's how it did happen.
No, that's a popular theory that they use that as, and then they use the mechanism that was in place for Castro. Well, Well, they were a lot less successful with Castro. You know, they were doing, again, if you were, again, I don't even know how much of the type of believe it's real. Did they
Did
really
Kennedy ever
try?
have an exploding cigar or anything?
Yeah, exactly. Exploding cigar, try to poison his beard. I mean, you know, just come on. I mean, this that's the
Wasn't
best they could think.
there an exploding conch shell or something? I don't know.
It's get
He's
smart stuff, you know?
I wonder if that's just planted.
Yeah.
Because it is. It's right out of was it predictive programming, all gadgetry and all that
Yeah,
stuff. But yeah.
I'm dubious of all of it. And we know, again, the Kennedys, and I go into this book, in my books a lot about the Kennedys and the demonization of the Kennedys. And I had a lot of it in history, how the left hates them, and especially the father, old Joe Kennedy. And I think I'm his only defender in the world. There's been so much misinformation, other than Robert F. Kennedy Jr., put out there about the Kennedys, especially from the left. You know, there are no enemies on the left, supposedly Saul Alinsky said, right before he dedicated his book to Lucifer, of all people, of all forces. Kind of a strange entity to dedicate your book to, Lucifer.
Well,
But
the ultimate rebel, right?
yeah, the ultimate rebel. But so these, but they are the enemies on the left for these people. The left despises the Kennedys, who ostensibly are on the left. And I have quotes and quotes from them everywhere. You know, people like William Kunstler, the radical, who I talked about in history, said that that he wasn't sad the Kennedys were assassinated, that the world was a better place without them. And again, this is, just imagine them saying, they're not sad Roosevelt died. They're not sad Harry Truman or even LBJ. No other leftist Democratic president is treated the way the Kennedys are. They get awful press, and they still do. And there's so much misinformation.
Well, if you look back at it, you talk about, if the objective, the motivation for the Kennedy assassination was the perception that Kennedy had betrayed them regarding Cuba, at least how they got the people to pull the trigger, got the
Right.
Cubans involved in it. Basically the CIA, or Kennedy restraining or going after the CIA, I want to break it into 1,000 pieces and cast it to
Right.
the wind and these things. That's very enticing, these little nuggets of evidence. Wow, that's, go against the CIA. Wow, he's going against the real, rulers of the universe, or masters of the universe. But it's very, at the same time, it's also very vague. But as you mentioned, we didn't, United States, there wasn't a policy reversal, and the United States did not try
No.
a second invasion of Cuba. With Vietnam, I think it was,
Yeah,
what was his name?
George Bundy?
No, the book, that JFK, written by
Oh, Fletcher
Mr.
Prouty. Yeah.
Fletcher Prouty. It's a
Yeah.
really well-written book. I enjoyed
Yeah.
reading it. He wrote very well,
Yeah.
and he posited it was Vietnam because he offered the evidence of the executive order that Kennedy signed
Right,
in
exactly.
1963 of
Yes.
withdrawing the
Yeah.
troops and getting out after the election. And that's also very enticing. And of course,
Yeah.
there was an escalation of the Vietnam War, of
Right.
course, in the following year. And after August 1964 and 65, you had the 100,000 troops in Vietnam, you had the escalation. So there's that. But it seemed to be that the big key was, whoever was behind the assassination, is they couldn't get Kennedy just out, because a scandal, which supposedly Kennedy was vulnerable to, would have also affected Lyndon Johnson because he was the vice president. But they needed Kennedy just out to install Lyndon Johnson. They got that with the assassination. And one, I think, Michael Collins Piper's book, he talks about there was a big policy reversal regarding Israel. And again, there
Yeah.
was this unreported war between Ben Gurion and
Right,
Kennedy
right.
regarding nuclear, I guess one of these, the right of
The nuclear
return
program,
and the nuclear program. And that's something that
right.
still goes unreported.
Right. Well, Kennedy was the last president. Well, Eisenhower. No, I don't know. I don't know if any of no. Really, Kennedy was the only president to stand up to Israel, especially in that way. And he was obviously the last one. LBJ went to the extent of covering up the USS Liberty incident, where they were attacked by Israel. So yeah, you're right. And so you have to look at what changed, and what changed is the Vietnam policy changed dramatically, because they escalated when LBJ's clear-cut new policy directed was to have everybody out by 1965. And if you want to look at an inside conspirator, I always name it George Bundy. George Bundy wrote National Security Act Memorandum 273 the day before the assassination, which contradicted 263, which is the one that set out the withdrawal policy. He had to have known that JFK would fire him after reading it. He was certainly never to sign it because it's changed his policy. So why would you do that unless you knew he wasn't going to be there? So I think this is one of those calling cards. And George Bundy was also in the White House Situation Room in Washington, D.C., and he assured the president's cabinet, who were all in the air flying back from Hawaii at the time. And he gave them an update, you know, only a few hours after the assassination, when nothing was known at all. Oswald, background information was there was no way everybody was saying this guy is the assassin. He said they had their man. There was no conspiracy. So, you know, that's a curious thing. And when you throw that on top of the fact he wrote that memorandum fired because all JFK would have never signed it, I think we can feel pretty secure in saying that he was an insider.
But, hello, you there? Oh, sorry, you broke up for a second.
Oh, yeah, okay, sorry. Yeah,
no, there's also, so, I think, was it Fletcher Prouty in New Zealand at the time?
Yeah, that was, he you know, some of the stuff it's hard to verify, but yeah, he said that.
Well, he claims that he was in New Zealand when he here, I think Christchurch, New Zealand, I think, or some military thing. And immediately it was reported, and almost immediately the newspapers had all this information on Oswald.
Yeah. Considering Oswald's background, what he was probably with the CIA and the FBI. There's lots of reason to think Lee Harvey Oswald was the informant who stopped the planned assassination attempt on JFK at the Army Navy game in early November 1963. And another.
That's right. There is a Secret Service agent, I think, that testified to that effect, didn't he?
Abraham Bolden.
That's right. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. But they said, you know, a teletype came in from an FBI informant named Lee, first name Lee, to the effect that, you know, watch out for an attempt on the president's life at the Army Navy game. So that gave JFK, you know, 20 more days to live or something. But so clearly this is, you know, and we know Oswald was he had people like, and we talk in the book about how Warren Breeds was an FBI agent in New Orleans who isn't looked at closely enough. And if you look at it, we have lots of information. This guy was everywhere. He was all around that ground level conspiracy. And when Oswald moved to Dallas, he moved to Dallas too. So he was following Oswald. No question about it. And so Oswald had a relationship with the FBI, some kind of informant. And of course, you know, we had testimony later for the HSCA that everyone in the CIA knew Oswald was the agency. He had a 201 file. I mean, they all knew it. So clearly he was with both agencies. So which one was he on assignment at the time? Who knows? But he was told by somebody.
And of course, Oswald and Maria's wife, I think, were squired by George Demornshield, this white Russian, his friend of the Bushes.
Oh, yeah, friend of the Bushes. And had dated Jackie Kennedy's mother, ounced baby Jackie on his knee.
That is, you can't reconcile that with the official narrative.
No, you can't. I mean, first of all, you know how, I mean, he was, Demornshield was old enough to be Oswald's father. And he was a career diplomat, almost an aristocrat from a very rich background. Again, if you're dating Jackie Kennedy's mother, you know, the Alton clause, the Bouviers and the Alton clauses, they had more money than the Kennedys. They kind of looked down their nose because the Kennedys were newer money. And these were older money. So they came from a very distinguished background. Anybody dating Jackie's mother had to come from that same upper crust.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the way those things work. So,
and weren't the Oswalds driven to Texas by the daughter of Mary Bancroft, who's a girlfriend of Allen Dulles?
Yeah, there's also
something like, right?
There is a connection there with Bancroft, who Oswald Dulles had.
Suppose you have this lone nut, marginal former Marine.
Yeah,
who's got a dead end job at the book depository? It's owned by this guy Bird, who hates Kennedy.
Right. Yes.
Okay. So, but nevertheless, this guy. Okay, he's got this job at the book depository, and he's a dead end job loser, but he's very good with a rifle. Whether it's a German Mauser or a Marlin Kirkcano, right? The other way, he gets this miracle shot off, but then he's driven to Texas by the daughter of the girlfriend of the director of the Central Intelligence
Right.
Agency.
There's so, and it just, so look at the DeMorento relationship again. There's the age difference, number one, and the class distinction. There's no, somebody of his, there's no way somebody, it's going to be odd enough that somebody that age difference is going to gravitate to some young guy. But why would he gravitate to a young Marxist defector? Again, DeMorento was a white Russian. He would have hated communism. So they didn't fit there. The age didn't fit. And Oswald was a minimum wage earning. But that just doesn't happen. And the only way it could possibly have happened.
He spoke Russian, by the way.
Yes, he did. That's why John Armstrong's Harvey and Lee theory is out there, because the recollections of those, it's all over the place. Some people said, you know, he spoke it as well as, you know, a native Russian. And of course, that Armstrong's theory is that Harvey was a native Russian. But if you could read that book for more on that. But there's so much of that. All of this is set against, of course, DeMorento would later be one of the many unnatural deaths when he supposedly killed himself right as he was about to be.
Yeah, that was like in the 70s, right?
Yes, late 77. And it
wasn't,
right,
what's his name? What's the guy from Fox News?
Bill O'Reilly.
Claimed that he was going to interview him just before he killed himself or something.
I will have a lot on that in my upcoming the American Memory Hole is going to be released in a couple of months here. And it's basically, and I'll have a lot about that. Yeah.
Well, there was a second like string of deaths in the 1970s during the House.
Yes, one of the main ones, because DeMorento had a conscience, and I have all these great quotes from him where he basically said Oswald didn't do it, and he expressed remorse.
Well, it's funny because you talk about the Cubans not knowing exactly what's going on. He may not know exactly what's going on. Just do this. Now, what he was, what I understand is, I remember reading about George DeMorinchil, was he was working for the oil companies in the Caribbean.
Yeah.
Now, again, oil company, Caribbean, going in and surveying these things. That is a perfect cover for an intelligence job.
Yes.
Or he may be actually be doing that, but he also working. He'd come and debrief or be debriefed by the CIA after he came back from his trip. So you gather intelligence as you're doing your job. You'd be sent on errands. So this is the type of errand he might be sent on if he's got nothing better to do. Say, hey, do this for us for a while, you know.
Right.
And in the 70s, I think in 76, he wrote a letter to George Bush, who was then director of Central Intelligence.
Yes.
Claiming that basically they were closing in on him or something. Of course, this coincides with the second investigation of the House Subcommittee on the Assassinations.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, at times, they looked at Bobby Kennedy, John F. Kennedy. Did they also look at Dr. King?
No, they just looked at King, and they didn't look at Bobby Kennedy.
But they did come away with the conclusion that indeed that the evidence suggests that indeed there was a conspiracy.
A probable conspiracy.
Yeah,
they said it was a probable conspiracy.
So that's the last official
word from the government. Yeah.
Let's move on.
Yeah, that's right. They just kind of dropped that out there, and so. Some of us are here, you know, all these years later, over 40 years later, that are still playing around with it. But I think this, again, this book has something unique in that it you really look at the background. They're really complex backgrounds to all these players in New Orleans. And I think you can see it doesn't take much to see the distinction between those. And I think all of those people, Bannister, Martin, certainly David Ferry, the anti-Castro Cubans, I think they all were being manipulated.
Mm-hmm.
And they were kind of patsies in their own way. They were, you know, that's why I think they also many of them. That's why when you look at Garrison's investigation, he when he tried Clay Shaw, he was about the only one he had left. You know,
yeah, they're all dying.
Yeah, they were all dying. And David Ferry probably would have been his most important witness. And of course, he died under very strange circumstances, you know, natural causes, but he left two typewritten suicide notes. on the fence, so I don't have any people go out that way, but that was interesting. And then you have all the witnesses that were scared to come testify. And Oliver Stone has a great scene with Julianne Mercer in there. Julianne Mercer reported seeing Jack Ruby, you know, walking up the grassy knoll, you know, about an hour or 2 hours before the assassination.
And of course, his real name was Jack Rubin, full name Jack Rubinstein.
Rubinstein, exactly.
And he worked for the Jewish Mafia, which was also involved in the illegal weapons, gun running, and weapons shipments for Israel.
Right.
You know, he was an agent for that
criminal
operation.
Well, he had Ruby had. I mean, his story is. Is amazing, and but you know, we don't go into him that much in the book, but he was part of that milieu, and obviously he was, you could tell by his Warren Commission testimony, tortured. And maybe he could only say so much, but these guys, I think, were all being used against one another. And as they saw, and that's why Dean Andrews Jr., well, his story is so, I think, heart-wrenching to me, because, you know, Dean III described how his father, I mean, I understand, I empathize with him. He did commit perjury, and he helped in the attack on Jim Garrison, the NBC hit job, everything else. But he saw the people that were dying. Like he said, I like to breathe.
Yeah, you know,
this great beatnik lingo, and he was trying to protect himself and his family. He didn't want to be another victim, and but in reality, behind closed doors, and Dean III tells that story, he was tortured. He was an incredibly he really lost his mind. He became incredibly paranoid. He would lock his youngest son, who just died a couple months ago. Dean just lost it, and he was after a lifetime of drug abuse.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he would have been. Had a problem with drugs if it hadn't been for what his father went through. And then Dean himself was in law school and would have been a lawyer too. But this impacted all of them. The mother and his widow, who's still alive, she's in her 90s, Dorothy, he came to my house and had dinner about 20 years ago. All the first Richard she talked to.
Yeah, I mean, anyone who asked questions, who could provide information, they were dying. And, I guess Garrison was too high profile. That would have been too obvious, I suppose. He suffered character assassination. You mentioned hit job on NBC. All the people in the press that are mobilized, we know that now. Of course, with Operation Mockingbird, it's not a surprise how that, you know, it's not difficult to understand how that operation would be pulled off. But the ones that did get, you know, died, was it Dorothy Kilgallen?
Absolutely, Dorothy Kilgallen, certainly. I think I'll go with the American Memory Hall. I have a lot more on that as well, too. But yes, there's no question. These people, so even people like Dean Andrews, they knew about the Dorothy Kilgallen. They knew about the people outside of Dorothy's, and they knew about the strange deaths there, but they knew closer to home. I mean, we have basically the double hit job when David Ferry dies the way he did in the same night. Eladio Del Valle, who was one of those Cubans that was in that group, was found with a hatchet put through his head. I mean, this is you know, exclamation point stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so these people are getting the message. And then you combine that with the fact that governors all across the country broke precedent, and they refused to extradite witnesses that Garrison needed. And so, you know, this was, you know, Gordon Novel was one of them that we talked about, a historian there. And there were governors like Ronald Reagan in California. John Connolly, of all people, who was shot during the assassination attempt in Texas. And this was unheard of. You know, usually when they, district attorney, when they want to extradite somebody, it's routine. Of course, especially in something in the investigation, the assassination of the president. And these guys, and again, people, the press, not only didn't question it, they just attacked Garrison and just questioned his motives, tried to, and, you know, Garrison was a, I don't hide the fact that, you know, I think he's a great American hero. And John Barber has become a real great friend of mine, and still going strong at 90 years old, former host and creator of Real People, Frank Sinatra's personal writer for several years. And he was the only man to interview Jim Garrison after the Clay Shaw trial. Came close to him and put together a couple great documentaries, the Garrison Tapes and the American Media and the Second Assassination of John F. Kennedy, the great, great documentaries out there. And I'm, you know, honored that we become close friends. But he told me a story that just shows the measure of the man. You want to know what kind of character Garrison had? After his entire, like so many whistleblowers, Garrison's family turned on him, especially his wife. And so that movie, what he said, you know, damn, Liz, I can't fight the whole world and you at the same time. Well, in real life, Liz left him out hanging to dry, as happens a lot. And so he lost his wife. His kids kind of, you know, I'm not sure what the relationship with his kids. I tried to get a hold of them. Love them, and it wasn't successful. But even though she had turned on him and rejected him in his moment of greatest need, when he was on his deathbed, John Barber tells the story where he called his ex-wife to his side and demanded that they be remarried so that she could get his lucrative pension as a judge. And I don't know how many people would possibly do something like that. That she'd feel betrayed, and but he was that he loved her, And that was his character. So I think that people that question him, I think that speaks more, you know, more loudly than anything else about what he did. So, you know, I don't hide the fact that I'm a big fan of Garrison's, and you know, he was prone to hyperbole sometimes, you know, and statements. He was always good, colorful copy, but you know, I don't know that for sure if he knew who killed JFK exactly at the top. You know, he did talk to, say, CIA as, you know, kind of a code for it, but he had that New Orleans group nailed down. He did a lot of great work on it. And I don't know if he, you know, was couching it in the same terms as I do, saying it was a ground level plot, but that's essentially what he was doing. He was the first one to call out the obvious and say that Lee Harvey Oswald was assignment.
Well, I guess going after Clay Shaw would have been a typical prosecutorial tactic or strategy or method of ladder climbing. I mean, you find.
Yes,
a person who's involved in it. He may not be the yeah. kingpin, but you get him, and then he starts, you know, spilling right. the beans, if you will. Yeah. But that was basically, it was in his neighborhood where he had discerned part of the conspiracy to kill the president. So he used his jurisdiction to open up an investigation. Certainly, they didn't bother to do that in Texas and Dallas.
No.
By the way, at the time, killing the president was not a federal crime.
Wasn't that so? That's people right. who realize that the Secret Service, in addition to not protecting the president, being in a real investigation, the first people that would have been questioned would have been the driver of the limousine, Bill Greer, who stopped or almost stopped the car, violated all security protocol. Mm-hmm. The agents in the backup limousine who didn't react at all in 6 seconds, and almost all of them, if not all of them, were out drinking till 5 a.m. against breaking.
Weren't they at Jack Ruby's bar?
No, they weren't at Ruby's bar. They were another bar, but that would have been greater. But that was, I think, the name of the club.
I think, didn't someone place Oswald at Ruby's bar at some time, too?
Oh, yeah, several times. There were lots of the MC there, some of the many of the strippers. And, you know, a lot of the strippers died, too. And so that was a thing. You know, you had people that
Well, the Secret Service apparently were more concerned with Kennedy's body after he was shot than
yes,
before.
Exactly. They didn't pretend, but
the doctor, didn't they go into the hospital there with guns?
Yes, they basically stole the body at gunpoint from the lawful.
Which is a violation of the law, violation of Texas law.
Yes, there was law, because as you said, at the time it was not a federal crime, so that's where the body had legal jurisduction. There was,
and by the way, once the president is dead, the Secret Service has no jurisdiction over the president.
Exactly.
Body.
Again, this was...
Yeah.
All protocol broke down because the entire thing was that, you know, basically it was put out there that Dallas had killed him. And you know,
that's like saying CIA did it.
Yes, exactly. But I mean, it's almost like, you know, it was a reverse of what we would see later, like with the Boston bombing, you know, the Boston Strong, where they credited a city, you know.
Yeah.
But back then they blamed the Chile, a city where Dallas had a black eye. And so, the idea was that the Kennedys, you had to get there, had to get Mrs. Kennedy out of there. She couldn't stand. I mean, okay. I mean, nobody has more feelings for the Kennedys than I do, but you know, you have to follow the law. And Earl Rose tried to stand up. He was the medical examiner there. He tried to stop them, but what was he going to do against a bunch of armed Secret Service agents? And
didn't they lose the brain at the naval hospital?
Well, we're still not sure about that. And, you know, in Hidden History, I found a Secret Service memorandum that's very curious, that talks about the brain being destroyed in a food service, in a food processor. I don't know what that means, but it's certainly not standard operating procedure, but it's out there.
Didn't Curtis LeMay oversee the...
Well, he was there, I think, and he was...
Why would the head of SAC oversee the autopsy?
Well,
the Air Force, anyway, isn't it? I mean,
well, one of the Pierre Fink, I think it was one of the three unqualified pathologists in there. Humes and Boswell were hopeless. Fink was a little more qualified, but still, it was as Harold Weisberg used to say when we talked about Kennedy getting an autopsy unworthy of a Bowery bum, is that the call should have gone out for the best pathologists they could find to do this. Instead, they got two people who really had no experience with gunshot wounds. It's unbelievably. So you got the autopsy that that you thought you would. And there's so much has come out of that. A missing film, exposed film, was it a secret film? What do the wounds really look like? And so many, so many things that we can, again, William Law knows more about than I do. He's talked to most of these people, but yeah, Fink claimed that there were generals and admirals there. And one of the admirals, one of the generals was giving orders. He wasn't sure who he was. Why was that happening? Kennedy wasn't a military guy. So, I mean, he was in the military, but he was still in the, he was an active member. So it made no sense. And that's why, you know, again, that's why you have things like David Lifton, you know, the best evidence to dual caskets, to dual bodies, the alter, body alterations and all that, the missing brain.
Didn't the Secret Service also wipe the limousine clean?
Oh, yes, they did.
And like, it wasn't flown up to like Michigan to get the windshield. I mean, it was like
windshield was replaced right away. Yeah, that's why they would have been in a real investigation. They would have been the first witnesses. They would have been grilled mercilessly, not only for the performance of the driver, the performance of the agents, you know, not doing their job, and then desecrating the crime scene, which is what they did by cleaning the limousine. Went to crime scene, they cleaned it up. If you see pictures of, you know, a bucket of water next to it and everything, wouldn't just saw it. And again, this is destruction of the crime scene. So, I mean, the Secret Service, they had to have been involved in some way. Now, why, you know, there's lots of theories where they, was this supposed to be as would happen so many times in the future from 9/11, Sandy Hook and Boston bombing, all these things where there are apparently drills going on the same day in the same area. Was this kind of drill? I mean, there are theories that they had been told Kennedy didn't take security, seriously, and they were going to have a mock assassination, something. And is that why the Secret Service stood down? I don't know. It's possible. And then once it really happened, maybe they, how do we, you know, explain this? And they kept their mouths. I don't know. And that's probably the most innocent explanation. And, but, you know, nobody knows for sure. But you're right. Once they did fly the limousine out of there, lots of witnesses saw a bullet hole in the front windshield, which would have, you know, obviously contradicted the story. A couple of people said they stuck a pencil through it. There, clear evidence of that. But again, they took the limousine away. They replaced the windshield. So who knows? Again, because they did these things, they destroyed evidence that we'll never know. But I think that the our book, Pipe the Bimbo and Reb, that's, you know, does lay out the case for that something was being, you know, fed. Like, for instance, we had Ann Dischler in there, who William was friends with for a while, but she worked for Garrison back in the day. And we have a transcript of a talk she gave at a conference that very few people have heard before. And she talked about what she was investigating. One of the things she was investigating was the Oswald impersonations in New Orleans. And most of us have heard about the impersonations in Dallas, where, you know, he went on the high-speed chase with Albert Guy Bogart, the car salesman, and said, maybe I'll have to go to Russia where they people enough to buy cars and all that stuff. And made sure he caused a scene at the gun range where he's shooting at the wrong target. And said, I thought that was Kennedy. You know, they obviously, and of course, Sylvia Odio, where he's they call him Oswaldo or something like that. He's trying to be, talking about how to kill Kennedy. Clearly, somebody was trying to put that impression in the public's mind, and it wasn't Oswald, obviously incriminating himself. But in New Orleans, you had the same thing going on. It's not very publicized. You know, somebody was impersonating him, making scenes, throwing up in bars, and, you know, things and making sure he dropped the Oswald name.
But then is he interviewed by local press about Fair Play for Cuba or something?
Oh yeah, he was interviewed on a television station, and
interviewed? Why would he be interviewed?
Exactly, and there was he was also on radio. Again, this is 1963, there aren't too many minimum wage earning guys that are getting TV time and radio time.
I mean, officially, isn't he working at a coffee company?
Yeah, exactly.
So he was punching a time card exact same time every day, and doing the exact same time every day.
Right. Yeah. You don't see that kind of coverage afforded to most minimum wage losers, as somebody, Geraldo, I remember calling him that. He was a loser, but he was a loser with a lot of interesting connections. So,
according to Judith Vary Baker, wasn't he called to like escort her around town because she was this prodigy teenager and in a big city? And that's, take you back to that book. But
I'm not real sure with what I know. She,
that's the storyline, and they fell in love or something. Yeah.
I mean, I think, I don't know Judith Baker, and I've heard lots of things about her, but if as I might kind of suspect, she's exaggerated her role, she wouldn't be the first person. You know, that kind of that happens in a lot of
embellish it. Yeah.
Right. Where there's some truth there, and maybe they start thinking their own role takes on more importance. I don't know. But I don't know. Like I said, I'm an agnostic on it. I don't know enough to comment about it. I apologize to her if it is the entire truth. But,
well, her story is it's not just the Kennedy assassination. It's also the cover-up for the polio vaccine, which killed people. And they had to cover it.
Certainly.
Yeah.
And again, at the center of that, you have that strange death of Mary Sherman. And that's she was killed
and
for
the weaponization of it, tried to create like a cancer-causing injection or something, which some people think Jack Ruby was shot up with in prison because he died of advanced cancer.
He claims what he claimed, and he was supposedly telling them. And then you have David Ferry, who was supposedly doing all kinds of cancer experiments with rats, all bunch of rats in his cages
in his apartment. Yeah.
So
yeah,
I mean,
the story was
So what was who knows? But there's so many of these compelling things. And one of the things we discovered, because another character that we talk about a lot in the book is Carrie Thornley, who is Oswald's Marine buddy. And if you look at pictures of him when he was younger, he's one of those that could impersonate an Oswald. He looked like him or resemblance to him. And the thing to know about Thornley, why he's important, Thornley was writing a book about Oswald before the assassination. Think about that. He was writing a book about the Oswald before the assassination.
Why would he write a book about a 23-year-old?
Exactly. He was inspired by him, his infection to Russia and all that. But most of what we know, like he claimed that the Marines called him Private Oswaldovich and all these things that nobody else said. And if you look at the testimony of the Warren Commission, Rick, most of the soldiers that served with him, it's like a one-page deposition. Thornley's testimony goes on for many pages. And he's clearly a key witness, and he's the one that puts a lot of the stuff out there that Oswald was in Russia, because a lot there you have other, and again, that's why Harvey and Lee, John Armstrong, finds other Marines who said that, he
it's
was
two
proud.
Oswalds, yeah.
Yeah. That Oswald was proud of his Southern heritage and proud to be named after Robert E. Lee. That doesn't sound like Private Oswaldovich. So what was going on there? Who really knows? And
he defects to Russia.
Yeah.
He's a Marine Corps serving out of Japan, right? Where he learns Russian.
Right.
And then he defects to Russia. Then he stays in a 4-star hotel.
And he's welcomed back with open arms.
And he marries
a colonel of a KGB guy. Yeah, exactly.
A daughter of a colonel of a KGB.
Yeah.
A pretty gal.
Her niece. Very pretty. Marie.
Very pretty. Takes her back. And then there's no investigation. He comes back to the United States.
No, they're going to debrief him. And so, I mean, it's just, it's absolutely ridiculous. But but Carey Thornley, what we discovered, it was Harold Weisberg did so much research that Oswald New Orleans is a book he wrote. It's probably his least read book. And ironically, he was the one who really started. He was Garrison's main investigator first. He did a lot of the legwork. And then he turned on Garrison for unclear reasons. I don't know. I met Weisberg and had dinner at his house when I was very young. A hero of mine, but the epitome of the grumpy old man. I mean, he hated everybody. So he was just a real, and I think he was jealous of Oliver Stone using Garrison, as the protagonist, and wanted to be used himself. So he turned on Garrison, but at that time he did great work. And one of the things that I found fascinating was that he went and interviewed the people, Oswald was passing out this Fair Play for Cuba pamphlets at Carlos Frangier. And him got into what looked like a stage fight, on the scene. And, even one of them, I think they say you can see Clay Shaw walking out of the trademark or something in the background. I don't know if that's true, but watching over his project. But Oswald, Weisberg went and found the print shop that printed up those pamphlets. And he wanted to know, Oswald had picked them up. And they said, no. And he wanted to find out who picked those pamphlets up. Bob was supposedly the only president, the president and only member of the Fair Play Cuba Committee. So he found some pictures, and he showed both the owner and then the woman, another woman that worked there, had been there in 1963. He showed them both separately. they both identified Carrie Thornley as the guy who picked up the pamphlet. So he was up to his neck in this. And I talked to a woman also that Sandra London, who knew Carrie Thornley, and she talked about how when he was writing his book about Oswald, he would sit outside in a cafe in New Orleans, and he would loudly talk as he was writing and also say all these horrible things, anti-Kennedy things in public. So he was a very strange guy. People have not looked at him closely enough. And, you know, my own writing was influenced a lot, especially my novel, The Unreal, which was influenced by the Illuminatus trilogy, Robert Anton Wilson and Robert Shea. And Wilson became close friends with Carrie Thornley. If you ever read that book, he comes up, Thornley was a fascinating guy. He came up with this Discordian philosophy. Mm-hmm. They were fascinated by this guy. And, you know, I didn't know Action Oswald at that point. I was very young. So, he's a fascinating character, and I think you know, just knowing that about the Fair Play for Cuba Committee connection is you know, it's one of the little tidbits. There's lots of that kind of information in the book. I think people learn a lot more than they knew before.
What's interesting is, of course, that Garrison's book Trail of the Assassins is adapted to the movie in 1991 by Raul Oliver Stone. Of course, the producer of the movie is one Anand Milhan.
Yes, that's right. Israeli arm, Mossad dealer, or whatever you had. Right? Yeah. I know.
And it's one of these things where this is a limited hangout control, because again, the movie itself says, you know, who did it. Well, again, it's this mystical CIA, the military industrial complex. You know, Dallas did it, you know, but there's no real, you know, no individuals you can point at, you know, in this.
Right.
But again, if you look at what changed was you were direct, because the Kennedy administration was the last administration to really challenge Israel,
right,
on some of these key issues, the Dimona plant, which you know, right, Kennedy was pressuring for inspections,
right,
and then you have Ben Gurion resigns,
right,
and then the assassination occurs, because we do know that Mossad, of course, has a vast network of assassins. Has been a part of their, you know, their policies, part of their statecraft, ever since the founding, even before the founding of the country. They engaged in terrorism, assassination to get what they right. want. And many of the people involved in those assassinations become prime ministers. You know, like Yitzhak Shamir, right? He killed, was it Benedat and the UN?
Was it Ariel Sharon? And Ariel Sharon? No, Menachem Begin.
Yeah, Menachem Begin. The King David bombing.
Yes.
But
with the Ergen gang.
Yeah. So that's all there. But there was a book, was it Rise and Kill, that came out recently or fairly recently about the Mossad in Israel, and bragging about, it's written by an Israeli. So it's bragging about, you know, how, you know, assassinations and other things are dirty games, extortion, bribery. It's just a part of statecraft. It's about, it's probably not reserved for Israel either, but Israel, they tend to excel at, and I think it largely explains the current state of affairs now in the United States, where there's such a Israeli lobby, the Jewish lobby, enjoys such overwhelming power now. At least it's disproportionate, if not dominant.
Right.
You're not just in this administration. This administration is probably worse than ever. But obviously, again, it goes back. Kennedy was the last president, him and Bobby, to really push back.
Right.
And they and Ben Gurion hated Joe Kennedy, because Joe Kennedy, of course, was an anti-interventionist during World War II.
Oh, yes. Yes.
And they don't forget.
Oh, Kennedy had old Joe Kennedy. And that's what I say. I write about him, and I'm probably his biggest defender. I think he was a great patriot, and he's been treated really unfairly with a bunch of lies. Almost all the lies, you know, come from. And you're right. In my book, American Memory Hole, I'm going to publish if they allow me to keep it in as an appendix, I'm going to publish the remarkable letter that young JFK, 22-year-old JFK, wrote to his father from a tour of the Middle East in 1940, I think. And it's such an incredibly mature analysis of the potential of the creation of a state of the Zionist state, you know, 8 years before they had one. And Kennedy just, and the way he writes to his father, it's clear they've discussed the topic of Jews many times. question. I mean, you can just read it, and I'm just shocked that he wasn't attacked for being anti-Semitic for that letter, because it's, you know, it could be interpreted that way. But he's very even-handed. He talks about how this will be a disaster, what'll happen over there, and so you know, the people in power knew about this. They knew about his father, and they knew about him, and you're right. He was the last one, obviously, to be to try to challenge Israel at all.
Well, and, from what I understand, during the campaign in 1960, he was approached by the Jewish lobby. I think it was Abraham Feinberg was the guy's name, who offered to bankroll his campaign. And he was in trouble, as he said. So we'll give you the money you need to get you over the top. And so Kennedy, as a result, then appointed a lot of Jews to his Middle East policy. We didn't let him take it over. And so what they I guess they would have seen it as sort of Kennedy reneging on a deal.
Regarding
the Middle East.
Well, he had, you know, they had to stand in line. I mean, a lot of people hated Kennedy, and he was the last president to go up against the Zionist lobby. That's for sure.
And of course, the CIA, we talk about CIA within the CIA, and we
absolutely
and James Jesus Angleton. So there's that. There's also the, I mean, people don't know about the Dimona and Numac in Pennsylvania. There was a plant that was refining, I guess, fissile material that was run by a couple Jews who then immediately transferred it to Israel.
Right.
Oh, well.
Yeah.
You know, but we take Onan Milchan, who was involved in illegal arms shipments to Israel. That was his thing. In fact, he got a medal from Israel, and he helps produce the JFK movie. But then this, it's not talked about. You know, it's again, it's... you're trying to find out who did it. Well, as you said, you know, there are a lot of people who have motives to be involved in the assassination.
Right.
But it is interesting is the one thing you cannot talk about is the Israeli angle.
Well, that's pretty much everywhere, isn't it? And, you know, it's an interesting thing because Oliver Stone is half Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
And he, but he's been very critical.
Yes.
Of Zionism. And so, I don't know. Why does he have this? Maybe he doesn't have that relationship anymore. I don't know. Because he hasn't made a lot of movies lately. So
No. So
I'm not sure. But it's interesting because he's very much on the other side, at least on the surface.
Mm-hmm. You know, and his son does a lot of, you know.
Sean. Yeah. Sean's a friend of mine. Yeah.
Yeah. But again, a lot of it is you know, your CIA taking the fall for for there are some researchers have commented on a third force. I mean, they based on the research, they indicate that there's some other element or higher level involved in this, and that would suggest that perhaps the Zionist angle might be a good.
Well, there are people that do that, and there's also people that we don't know what Permandex was exactly. There's that's why Shaw's connection to Permandex is. I mean, I know because, and of course you want another Jewish name. There was a Colonel, was it Major Louis Bloomfield,
mm-hmm.
who was like or Bloomfield, that was connected to Permandex in some way, and people make a lot about him. So you know, we go into again the strange connections of Permandex, and that's why you know it is really a. As Donald Sutherland says, you know, Mr. X character based on Fletcher Brown in the movie is that, you know, it's a parlor game. I mean, we can sit there and say who, and that's why, I never say like, I know who killed Kennedy. Cause I don't know exactly, but I know I start from the premise that, you know, that,
you know, who didn't
exactly. I start from the premise that whoever killed him, it wasn't Lee Harvey Oswald. They proved that conclusively, you know, inadvertently. So,
well, Permandex seems to be like a company set up a front to provide logistics and funding for international like hit squads.
Yeah, that's certainly the way the Warren Beatty movie, you know, promoted it. So what is Clay Shaw doing in an outfit like that? And when we go to
didn't Clay Shaw have a background in OSS?
Yes, yeah, so, and he also was associated in some way with Operation Paperclip.
Yes, which is, again, so he's working, so evidence suggests he's working for a company that's owned by a Jewish banker who's tied in with Israel. At the same time, he's working for Operation Paperclip, which smuggled Nazis into the country.
Yeah. Right, right. Yeah, so that's why I said there's
so all of a sudden the narrative and the sides were given, the right versus left, allies versus Nazis.
And that's what I'm saying. I always try to start at the ground level. In this case, it's a ground level conspiracy, but in Dallas, if you want to look to the larger conspiracy, I think again, our book, if you look at this ground level conspiracy, it opens a lot of eyes, okay, that all these people are being manipulated, and it also destroys the smoke screen of the Cuban connection. So you eliminate that. Stop looking at Cuba. And obviously we know it wasn't Castro that killed him, as some people still believe, amazingly. And it wasn't anti-Castro Cubans. They didn't have the power. That's why I always used to argue with these people. They said, well, you know, it was an anti-Castro exile community and some rogue elements of the CIA and maybe the mafia. And I always say, do you really think that rogue CIA agents and anti-Castro Cubans, that these people could have controlled the entire
national So the mafia media? ordered the Secret Service to steal the body?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. The mafia ordered that. And they
controlled the... And the white plane, the limousine.
They got the New York Times and the Washington Post and NBC News. I published that in Hidden History. Shocking. They agreed, and it's in writing. You can find the document out there, that they agreed to, 2 days after the assassination, they agreed to only broadcast information that was consistent with the FBI's theory of the assassination. It doesn't get any more blatant than that. And that's when you had three networks.
Did the mafia get Dan Rather to misrepresent the Zapruder film?
Exactly. Dan Rather said, exactly. So, yeah. There's, you know, saying that.
Did they get Time Life to sequester the film for a decade?
Yeah, they did.
Then manipulate it? I mean.
Yeah. So that's why it has to be. So you can figure.
Well, I think we got the idea what the hierarchy was here, because in 1976 or 75, when they're reinvestigating the assassination, Sam Giancana, who was the top mobster, ends up cut up in the little pieces.
And Johnny Roselli ends up in an oil drum. Yeah. So you're right. So there's a...
Well, yeah, Sam Giancana shot in the mouth, and Johnny Roselli's cut to pieces. That's right.
Yeah.
But Johnny Roselli had been recruited for Mongoose, though.
Right, Roselli. A lot of people think he was one of them. I mean, who knows who the gunmen were? Oscar Wyatt, him, you know, this French guy. I mean, there's no way of knowing. And you know, the gunman may have been killed right after. Who knows? But it's who plotted it? Who conspired to do this? And I think, you know, it's reasonable speculation to say people like Curtis LeMay and Alan Dulles knew about it. I think McGeorge Bundy, because what he said. But I start the premise. Okay, let's look at what happened. If I'm investigating the crime, I'm going to start at the beginning, and I'm going to look and say, what happened that day? Okay, well, the most obvious thing that happened is that the Secret Service didn't act the way they normally acted.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, my friend Vince Palomero, who wrote Survivor's Guilt, is the expert on the Secret Service. He analyzed that, and I've communicated with him a lot. He told me that, you know, that day, that motorcade was very different. You know, he analyzed all, because first of all, most of the time you had agents jogging beside the limousine. A lot of times you had an agent on the bumper. In fact, Clint Hill was on the bumper of the
limousine. Yeah, they're called off. There's a film on Love. Was it Love Field where they're called off?
Yeah, so and in Hidden History, and William Law helped me with that, by the way. You know, in Hidden History, where I was able to contact the family of Henry Ripka, who I think was a Secret Service agent. Vince thinks it was a guy named Donald Law. I think it was Henry Ripka, who died very young. And the way his son acted when he talked to William, I talked to his granddaughter, and he talked to his son, where he, you know, people can read about it in Hidden History. I can't remember exactly, but he acted, you know, very, very strangely, let's put it that way. But you're right. Ripka throws his hands up like, what the hell? You know, what do you mean? And he's clearly being waved off as he was starting to jog alongside the limousine, as he usually did, in the press car. Reason why you see nothing but jiggling motion in the camera and somebody like running when they're hit, the reason is because the press car that day, exclusive to all other motorcades, every other motorcade, the press car was in front of the limo and camera trained right on JFK's handsome tan face for a close-up. That day, there were five or six cars back in a bus. So they had to jump off the bus and run and take. So that's why, you know, if we had had professional footage, which we should have, then we would have these arguments in the Zapruder film. Was it altered, you know, in the Butch Gilady's film, who we still don't know who that was or where it was. We've never seen it. That would have been so we only had these home movies to the assassination because no professional footage was taken from the time. The last professional footage you see is Henry Ripka throwing up his hand saying, what the hell, at the airport as soon as they left Love Field and started the motorcade. It's nothing but home videos that luckily there was lots of people taking. pictures and home movies, but not that we'd have no evidence. We'd like it'd be like the RFK assassination, where you literally know no film at all of what happened.
Well, that was stolen. That was that there was the that photographer who sued to get it back, and it was stolen.
Scott Endred, yeah, I've had him. Yeah. But you know, Scott Endred, I've had him on my show. He apparently now believes there wasn't a conspiracy. So I don't know how they get to this. Yeah, they stole. I mean, they slashed the tires of a car that was delivered. I mean, it's, you know, so I don't know how, but I mean, I think he's writing a book or something. So maybe, you know, he's, I can't blame people, but I know William Law used to know him too. And William Law said when he interviewed him out in California, he, you know, he talked about how he kept a gun under his chair because he didn't want to get, and he was very paranoid. So I don't know, but that's, he's the one you're referring to. And that was just a still film too. Photographs. They might have shown something, which I'm sure they were showing something, but there was no video. It was again RFK. There was video of everything. That's on to Chicago, and let's win there, and then you can kind of see him walking, and then they take the unscheduled detour through the pantry where he's led back there,
yeah,
to his death. But if you had had, why weren't the video? They do follow him a certain way, and then they stop where he gets to the kitchen. So is that intentional? I don't know, but certainly in Dealey Plaza, it's very frustrating because we can only imagine if there's, I mean, I'm sure it would have been horrible to watch, but if the press car is as close as they were, you see, you know, when they're from full frontal, you see Kennedy's waving, certainly that would have been amazing to, and it would have solved a lot of questions.
Yeah, I never wondered, you have a president showing up in Dallas, which was a bigger, you know, a big thing, especially back then, and there's no, like, you think there'd be a lot more film, like professional film on there.
Yeah, man, that's why, because they pulled off, and they and again, that's the entire motorcade is what's in question. There's so many figures. Was Lee Harvey Oswald really in the doorway? And all these things that, you know, people hear, all these other characters, George W. Bush walking around, you know, George H.W. Bush, you know, all these things that people claim. Professional footage probably would have helped clarify some of that, or even something like, you know, could Oswald, nobody pictured Oswald leaving the scene.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the official explanation is that he left, you know, 3 minutes after the assassination. No evidence for that. No witnesses, nothing. They just had to have him leave that time to get the place where Officer Tippett was shot, but not by him, but they claim was by him. But he still couldn't get there in time, but that was what they had to do. And if you'd had, you know, professional cameras trained all in the area, you know, a lot of constant video, he had to have left at some point. So you would have had that footage. So it's, there's so many things that are, and of course there's Harold Weisberg in his book, Photographic Whitewash, another overlooked book. He talked about, I mean, there's so many people that took film that day that we've never seen. I talked in the American Memory Hall, I'll talk about the film of a guy named Ralph Simpson, another guy who's kind of reputation I try to restore, Sergeant Keene of the Dallas Police, who most of the other critics hate. I think the guy's a hero. I talked to his daughter and became friends with her, and she talked about the mysterious accident he had where he was very close to being another unnatural death. He survived, but he had to retire. Behind the scenes, he was very paranoid. But his testimony is fantastic. Next to Dean Andrews Jr., That's the Beatles of the Warren Commission testimony. Most of it's boring, but Dean Andrews Jr. is wonderful. It's you'll be entertained reading it.
Dean Andrews is the guy who was asked by Clay Shaw, to be the lawyer for Lee Harvey Oswald, right?
Right, and that's where
Clay Bertrand was Clay Shaw's
right. I can't believe we've been touching on so many other things, the main reason why. Garrison was drawn to him. Not only was he his friend, but he reasoned that he got a call. He was in the hospital on the day of the assassination. He gets a call in the afternoon of the assassination from a Clay Bertrand. He said, I knew Bertrand used to send, again, this is where we're talking about, they're all being manipulated. Bertrand sent him clients, mostly the gay caballeros, these Cubans, to help with immigration. And of course, he claimed he was helping again. Oswald's being manipulated too. He's told to go to Dean Andrews Jr. Yeah, I'm just speculating, but it's pretty reasonable speculation. And Dean Andrews said, hey, this guy, you know, is, watch out for him, maybe. I don't know. And he's there to help me with my dishonorable discharge, help me with my wife's immigration status from Russia. But he's told on the day that he gets his call to represent it. So he says he agrees to do it. He calls his secretary, who strangely says, "No, I can't go to Dallas with you." He calls his own lawyer, Monk Zeldin, and so he has people that admit he called them the day of the assassination and said, "Hey," and but eventually through coercion, you can see the Warren Commission testimony, and certainly testimony later before the New Orleans grand jury and things like that, where he and the Shaw trial, you can see him back in. We have all his testimony in there, so people can see the transition of his testimony from "I got what" and everything to "maybe it was drugs, you know, maybe I dreamed it up, you know, that kind of thing." And so I, that's one of the questions, is why was he? And the only reason I can say, again, because I think he was part of this grand level conspiracy, and I think he was being manipulated. I don't know why they wanted to suck him in like that and tell him, because presumably they knew they were going to kill Oswald. So why would they be bothering to ask somebody to represent him?
Yeah.
But for whatever reason they did, I think for sure they did. He wouldn't, I don't, this, I mean, and this is what made Dean Andrews Jr. lose his mind and destroy. The guy was president of the New Orleans Jazz Festival. He was one of the most distinguished members of New Orleans society. He you know, was well known to everyone. Again, he was hobnobbing with the likes of Jim Garrison. So why would you give up that lifestyle, destroy your family, and making up a story like that? So I think he was torn. This was something that really happened. He probably couldn't figure it out either. Why the hell did they do that? And we know from Dean the Third in the book that I interviewed says, yes, of course, Clay Bertrand, he knew on the scene. So it's no secret. But so that was one of the foundations of where Garrison wanted to go. But again, he had Dean Andrews Jr. had been a cooperative witness. Again, if he could have had Gordon Novell and all and these people from other states that weren't being extradited, if Julianne Mercer hadn't been scared, if David Ferry hadn't been murdered, if that Guy Bannister didn't die conveniently before the Garrison investigation, Jack Martin, we talked about him. He's an enigmatic figure. He was played by Jack Lemmon in the movie, getting beaten up by Ed Asner, pistol whipped supposedly. In real life, Martin was kind of a fearsome character himself. And we can't find any record of Martin's death. I mean, he has to be dead. He'd be, you know, well over 100, but
Yeah.
there's no record of it. So I don't know what happened. But we talk about a lot of that in the book. There's a guy named Jim Hicks that was a Garrison witness and talked about, you know, being he, basically he was a radio, he said he was a radio man in Dealey Plaza, and he's talking to, and we so again we and again they said he was just beaten up by three people and thrown off a motel balcony. This stuff happened, you know, routinely to people, like, and placed in a mental institution. We'd heard for years rumors, a couple of critics, that he was murdered. After a lot of research, we were able to find an obituary that said he was murdered. And so he's another member of the body count, the JFK body count. So these are things that nobody really, they're not in any other books, the details of this. So you get a lot of exclusives here, but again, it shows that the New Orleans was important. Because where the I think it's where the false foundation was placed for if there was a fallback, if for whatever reason they abandoned the lone nut hypothesis, they were going to go with this anti-Castro Cuban thing. They were going to implicate these guys who were all vulnerable. I mean, what would they have done? You know,
Yeah.
it would have been easy to implicate its conspirators.
And some say that's also cover, saying that it would justify a cover up because they didn't want World War III to start because of the assassination.
Yeah, and that would that and that's, you know, that's the inference. They said Earl Warren, that's what LBJ prevailed on to serve on the Warren Commission, you know.
It's a noble lie. Yeah,
Yeah, it's a
noble lie.
noble lie, which is, you know, nonsense. And some of these researchers believe it's nonsense, and this was a benign cover-up. Look, I talked in Hidden History about how they tracked down a woman who had babysat the infant Lee Harvey Oswald and hadn't seen the Oswalds for, you know, over 20 years. And she testified for pages over what he was like as an infant.
Yeah.
And they testified that they have another woman who knew Mrs. Oswald before Lee was born. And again, she gets extensive testimony. She's witness to nothing. Yet they don't call Admiral Berkeley, who was the president's private physician, the recipient of all the autopsy medical evidence of this very bogus autopsy, was there at the Parkland Hospital, was there at the Bethesda Naval Hospital, wasn't sitting beside Kennedy. There's some indication from Fletcher Krause and other that a lot of times the president's physician was supposed to be seated in with him. I don't know if that's true, but that's what he claimed. But he wasn't called as a witness. A couple of the closest witnesses, including the Babushka lady, who was one of the closest witnesses, you can see her in the Russian scarf. That's what they call the Babushka lady. She's holding a motion picture camera to her face, and she's filming from a closer range than Zapruder from the other side of the street. She would have got the grassy knoll in the background. Nobody knows who she is. I mean, Beverly Oliver claimed she. I don't know. Again, I'm an agnostic on that. Doesn't look like an 18-year-old stripper and that thing, but that's what she would have been at the time. But regardless, they never tried to find her, and they never tried to find her film. So these people weren't called as witnesses. Some of the closest witnesses there weren't some of the most important witnesses, and yet they tracked down a benign cover-up. That takes a lot of research to find somebody that babysat baby Lee Harvey Oswald. And so they were purposely padding the record and creating a massive disinformation, 26 volumes of hearings and exhibits. And
yeah, well, Alan Dulles said, when talking about the report, he said, "What, don't worry about it. No one reads.
Yeah, right? A few professors are reading. And he was right.
Yeah.
Well, and they also, they made it cost prohibitive because I think they priced it at $80.
Yeah,
a lot of money, yeah, in 1963. And they made you buy all 20, because most people wanted the testimony. Most of the exhibits are meaningless. So most people wanted, but you couldn't do that.
Yeah.
You couldn't buy just the hearings, whatever. So you had to buy the whole thing for $80. I know when I was first researching it, I had to go to my central library, where that was, the reference set. I don't think you can check it out. And there were other libraries that didn't have it, but I couldn't buy it. I mean, I remember when I was a teenage volunteer for Mark Lane, I saw his, set and all his cool little notations. I was looking at him in his office, but where he'd made all these notations, and Harold Weisberg had a set. But for most people, it was financially infeasible. So most people bought the Warren Report, which is 888 pages of garbage.
If Walter Cronkite isn't reporting to the people, it's not happening. And that's
right.
Most people get their news. To this day, it's still filtered to the mainstream press. And that's the importance of Operation Mockingbird.
Right. It doesn't get much more Mockingbird than Walter Cronkite. Cronkite, the voice of the owl for decades at Bohemian Grove.
And then, of course, Dan Rather's rewarded because he follows Walter Cronkite at CBS.
Yes, days. He was. He...
So they're both connected to that. And it's again, you have a sitting president who's apparently butting heads with Central Intelligence Agency with the in regards to policy in Cuba and Vietnam. There's all types of problems with the mob, and then there's also then the run-ins with the Israelis. But we're supposed to believe that he's taken out by a lone nut, who, if you just scratch the surface, wasn't a lone nut. He had all these connections back to the very, very people who are connected to this milieu, if you will, whether it's New Orleans, the mob, intelligence connections, direct connections to like people like Dulles, or basically one step removed. So it doesn't, again, the official narrative just doesn't stand up to scrutiny. And in your book you have all these names, it's your array of names, and it takes an investigator like Garrison to connect all the dots, and that's what they're right. supposed to do. And of course this wasn't done, and when you had one prosecutor doing it, his whole case was undermined and obstructed by the very government that was supposed to of course uphold the law and find out who did it. Well, elements of that government were involved in it, so
right. And Garrison really was out on his own, because you had people like Weisberg who, even the Warren Commission critics, and keep in mind there were never Jim Mars. You mentioned Jim Mars, great guy, mm-hmm. I very much. And I just started to get to know him a little bit before he died too young. And he wrote some great books. Crossriser, a wonderful place to start for people in the assassination. But Mars was originally a newsman in Dallas for Dallas Paper, and he and Earl Gold, who was on the competing paper, they were the only mainstream reporters other than Dorothy Kilgallen. Dorothy Kilgallen was going to write a book about the assassination. She was maybe the most famous woman in America at the time. She was on What's My Line, and mm-hmm. I was shocked when I started researching for American Memory Hole that so many of the people like Mark Lane and the early critics, they got a lot of their information from Dorothy Gilgong, because she was a real investigative reporter. She had the wherewithal, the big New York newspaper she worked for. And she published a lot of this early evidence in her column. I didn't realize that she was the first source for this. And ironically, the other first source was Marguerite Oswald, Lee Harvey Oswald's mother. And I have a lot more to say about her in that book too. She's been treated very unfairly, and it really is probably the first so-called conspiracy theorist. And she tipped off a lot of these people as well. And but Dorothy Gilgallon was the only reporter I know of who was investigating the mainstream. And she was collecting notes to write. She would have written the first book and probably the biggest book on the JFK assassination. It would have been bigger than Rush to Judgment, Mark Twain's book, except of her standing in the community. Well, she died very conveniently. Her notes were never found. And then the rumor is, according to Penn Jones and others, that she entrusted her notes to her best friend. Her name was Edie Smith. And who, shockingly enough, just by a magnificent coincidence, had been one of young JFK's back in the days girlfriends. And just happens to become Dorothy Kilgallen's best friend, dies at a very young age, 2 days after Dorothy Kilgallen. Ever found her. Dorothy Kilgallen's husband ends up killing himself years later. I tried to track down Dorothy Kilgallen's children, but unsuccessful in getting a hold of them. But because her father, Dorothy Kilgallen's father, lived to be well into his 90s and actually contacted the House Select Committee on Assassinations. I'll have that in the book. Very curious stuff. But at any rate, she was the only mainstream journalist who was going to write a book. And the only other mainstream journalist that did real investigative reporting on the case out of the mainstream was Jim Mars and Earl Golds. And they interviewed a lot of these witnesses later in the 70s who came out and decided finally to talk or talked about how they're. Many of them talked about how the FBI statement, the issue was wrong. They had distorted what they'd said. And so very interesting stuff. But if you, other than that, the people who did all the investigations were people like Mark Lane, who was a New York City alderman, Harold Weisberg, who was a retired chicken farmer, or a retired OSS officer, a worker who became a chicken farmer. Sylvia Marr, who worked for the World Health Organization, Shirley Martin doesn't get credit. She was just a housewife, did fantastic work, died way too young again. And so these are the people that did the real investigation. No professional journalist did any work on it at all. And that's why if they had done the investigation at the time, they'd done what Dorothy Kilgallen did, then they would not have been able to pull it off. They needed the media, as Garrison said. They had to know that the media was going to play ball with them. And they did. Boy, NBC let them know, 2 days after the assassination, hey, yeah, we'll agree. We'll just report whatever the FBI says. I mean, that's, to think that they were making fun of Taz and Pravda at the same time they were doing this. It's just, what's the difference between that and state-run media? That's
well, difference isn't so even they admit it.
Yeah.
People know it.
Yeah, exactly. And here in America, they're too, the majority of the people are still too controlled and stupid so that they think we have a free press. But so it's left. And, again, 60 years later, it's people. I mean, why, I write about this stuff because nobody, and this research is, and I've had great help from people helping me out with the research. People like Chris Graves and Peter Sikosh done a lot of great work for me and just feed me information and make it a lot easier, because the research is kind of hard now with the search engines. They really censor this.
Yeah,
stuff
they don't there. Not like yeah, the Google's useless.
So
the book, Pipe the Bimbo in Red, Dean Andrews, Jim Garrison, and the Conspiracy to Kill JFK. It's been released. How long has it been out?
It's probably been maybe three. I think it came out in it came out right before the assassination. I think it came out early November
2023 on the 60th anniversary. Where should people get it?
You can get any of the usual places. I say look for the best deal, Amazon, Barnes and Noble, whatever. I don't get any and it just to answer the question about the title, Pipe the Bimbo in Red, it's not, and people have wondered about that, but that's a line, a beatnik line from Dean Andrews Jr. And it's right at the beginning.
Figured,
I mean, that's when he's sitting in the restaurant, that great memorable scene, John Candy and Kevin Costner, And he checks out this woman and walks like, type the bimbo in red, you know. And so that's, it was William's idea, so give him credit or blame for it. He wanted to, and it's a provocative title and it gets people's attention because they say, what does that mean? So that's,
Yeah.
he just wanted to get the beat because he, that's Dean Andrews Jr., essential part of his character is that great big Nick language that he had. And I think that expresses it pretty well.
Yeah, correct. Okay, Don, thanks for coming back on the show.
Absolutely, Tim. It's always a pleasure. Appreciate it.
Good night then. Bye-bye.
Take care, man.